About 5 or 6 weeks ago, we started out in our study of the last paragraph of Romans 8, which is the last paragraph of the section that primarily focuses on Paul's view of sanctification. And we've worked our way in the text down to or through verse 32. And this evening we're going to begin to look at the other half of the issue that he has raised in verse 32, that God is for us. Actually, verse 31, God is for us. Verse 32 is the positive side of that. He didn't spare his son, but delivered him up for us all, and he's willing, therefore, to give us freely all the things that are necessary for life and godliness in light of that provision. But in verses 33, 34, and 35, he raises the other half of that thing, that there are adversaries. Who can be against us is what he asks in verse 31. And we're going to look at the against us kind of stuff in these verses as we start out in verse 32 this evening. But so far in our studies of this paragraph, we've noticed that there are seven basic questions that Paul raises through the text. And we've looked at the first three of those seven. The first question asks for a firm conclusion. What shall we say to these things? A firm conclusion to the declaration of the previous paragraph, verses 26 through 30, where he talks about the ministry of the Spirit to us and about the fact that God is working everything together for our good, because in the past, long before in the past, he made certain decisions, and they are firm, and they are done in eternity, perhaps even before he created time. But in the outworking of the promises, there is this medium of time where there's a consecutive succession of events that transpire. And in the consecutive succession of events, God is working everything together for our good. So the commitments that he made before are now being worked out in active history. So God is transcendent above us, and he is imminent. He is present with us. And the issue for us, for especially Romans 8:28, is whether we actually believe that or not. Because actually believing Romans 8:28 tempers our escapist desires. Every time something goes away we don't want it to, we want delivered from it. And if we really understand that he's working everything together for our good, that doesn't mean we deliberately staying in a situation that's not good for you. He's not asking us to do that. But he is saying, since God is working everything together for our good, we should be willing at least to ask the question of whether we ought to try to get out of this situation or not, or even get into a situation that looks very promising from the outside. Because regardless of what decision we end up making, he's still going to work everything together for our good, but our peace of mind and emotional stability will be greater because we're operating by faith. And, of course, verse 29 and 30 are the foundations for that faith. And then in verse 31, he asks for this firm conviction that God is for us. What shall we say to these things? God is for us. And then he says, who can be against us? That's the second question. And that second question, the two parts, God is for us, who can be against us, who is against us, is actually the answer to the first question. What shall we say this? Well, we should say God is for us. We should also say, who can stand against us? Because God is for us. So the second question answers the first. And then the third question, as we've already pointed out, addresses the first part of the second question. He is for us. And verse 32 says he didn't spare his own son. He is so for us that when he considered whether he had to spare his son or subject us to the wrath, he did not spare his son. He gave him up for us. And he is also so for us that because he would give the greatest provision for our life and godliness, he will also give us everything that's necessary that's below that for life and godliness. And I really think that if we understand that God is for us, it addresses a lot of the problems that are created in human minds when they operate in unbelief, because we magnify our difficulties when we are operating by unbelief. And if we would just trust God, a lot of that magnified difficulty that we face would be diminished. So he wants us to understand that God is committed to providing everything that we need for life and godliness, because he's already demonstrated that he's willing to give the greatest gift there was. So that's the explanation of the God is for us thesis of the first and second questions. Now, we come to the fourth question in verse 33, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? That's the fourth question. And it, along with question 5, who is he who condemns us? And then 6, verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And then 7, shall tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword separate us? That's the idea. So we're starting to look at the fourth question, but it is the same theme in questions 5, 6, and 7, and all of those verses address the second part of the second question. If God is for us, is the first part of the second question, then who is against us? And so he introduces this whole issue of opposition. Who is against us? That's the issue. And he says, well, there are some who are against us because they'll try to bring a charge against us. There are some who will try to condemn us. There are some who are trying to separate us from the love of Christ, and they'll use various means, tribulation, distress, persecution, and so forth. But they're doomed to fail. That's his whole point. So there are four questions to address regarding this second part of the thesis, and it's the biggest part of the paragraph. So that implies that Paul knows that it is more difficult to really believe that God has overcome those that are against us, because they come at us from all these different directions, and we say, well, I know God's for us, but these guys are against me, and they're going to do this to me and this to me. And Paul is saying, well, wait, you can't believe that God is for you and expect that he's going to allow them to do stuff against you that will succeed in the area that he's talking about. He's not saying that God won't let a thief break in your house and steal something of yours. He's not saying that. But whatever that thief steals is not a part of your spiritual life. So it's not going to, I mean, unless you have a wrong fixation on the possessions, it's not going to derail you if you understand that God is for you. And so in this long section from verses 33 all the way down through verse 35 and even verse 36, the whole focus here is how do you deal with the fact that there is this powerful opposition. It shows up in its potency with the words in verse 35. Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. That's a lot of different ways that people can be against you. So we're going to look at these issues. There are those who seek our ruin. How are we supposed to deal with that? Well, verse 31 says, one of the things we should say to these things is God is for us, and those that are against us can't succeed in the ultimate sense. Now, there's obviously a temporary or an appearance of success in some of the nefarious schemes of the adversary. And he is a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour. And sometimes we do feel like we have been devoured. But the feeling is all rooted in a lack of understanding of what Paul is saying here. Because God's for us, and therefore we can't lose. Not really. But all the way through the scriptures, we run into this reality that we think about this deep about stuff, and God is seeing a whole range of things beneath our perception about us that we don't perceive or even think about unless it is brought to the surface and stuck right in front of our faces. And that's when we realize just how complicated and how complex things might get. And that's designed to get us to trust God through the complexity. Because it doesn't bother him. I mean, he's omniscient and can understand all that stuff. But we are not. And we will actually give away our areas of faith and unbelief by the words we speak, because we reveal the fears that we have or the confidences that we have by the way we speak. So, one of the things we're going to start with in verse 33 is the tactics of our opponents. And at the root of their tactics is a very fundamental admission. The opponents themselves have to admit that God still remains, quote, God, unquote. That is, he is the ultimate executor of power, and nobody in his creation can do anything without his tacit permission. Everything has to pass his evaluation, and he has to say yea or nay. And even the devil, when Satan came before the heavenly hosts in Job chapter 1, he challenged God about Job, but God said, okay, you can do this, and but not any further. This is your boundary. You can do this, but not any further. This is your boundary. And the opponents, in a very real sense, by the statement in verse 33, that they're attempting to bring charges against God's elect, they're admitting that they're having to bring this into God's court and, in a very real sense, seek to persuade him to turn against us because of the charges that they're laying. They know they can't do anything to us without his permission. So if they want to destroy us or ruin us, they have got to get God to see us in such a light that he will turn against us. That's got to happen. And they admit that. Their accusations are lodged against us, but they're lodged against us in the presence of someone who can and will decide the situation as it's being set up in a court kind of thing, because that's where charges are laid. And the text tells us that God will never listen to their charges. I mean, he'll listen, but he isn't going to be swayed by any of the charges that they make for reasons already given in the previous text. But this admission that God remains God is huge. Because our adversaries are fundamentally committed to attempting to intimidate us to get us under their authority and dominion. That's their whole goal. They want to try to get us to be intimidated by their tactics so that we give up the fight or we are influenced by their pressure to do something that we ought not to do. That's their whole intent. And the implication of that is they want us to treat them like little gods. But in order to get that to happen, they have to go before the big God and lay a charge. So they admit that God remains God. And in this admission, they are, in a very logical way, they're admitting that they're not. A God can do anything he pleases because that's what gods are. They're executors of authority and power, and they do as they decide. They can do whatever they wish to us. But by the fact that they have to bring a charge before God, they're admitting that they can't do whatever they please. And there's really no point in laying a charge against somebody if, in fact, the one who's laying the charge is the final arbiter of how it's going to be handled. I mean, if they can do whatever they want to do to us, they won't even bother to lay the charge. They'll just do it. The very fact that they have to lay a charge against us means that they know their boundaries. And the demons are that way. They know their boundaries. In a lot of the demoniac stories in the Gospels, you run smack into this realization that the demons hate Jesus. They do not want to have to do what he says. But every time he tells them to do something, they have to do it. They may do something to their temporary host. They may, you know, twist the knife a little, make him screech or fall on the ground and froth at the mouth or whatever. But when Jesus says leave, they are on their way out because they know they have no other options. And there was at least one story where Jesus showed up and the demon said, have you come to torment us before the time? They were just admitting, hey, we know the boundaries. And even in Revelation, where Satan is cast down to the earth and he's going to try to bring a wholesale rebellion against God on the earth in humanity, the text tells us he knows he has a short time only. So, he knows. He's limited. So that's one of the first things that needs to be understood in terms of their tactics. At the very root of their approach is this fundamental admission that God remains God. And another thing along that same line is the way Paul phrased it, because he doesn't say, who shall bring a charge against us? He did say in verse 31, who is against us? But when he goes to the specifics in verse 33, he says, who will bring a charge against God's elect? He deliberately switches over to our identity as the elect of God. And that means that their accusations lodged against us mean that they're really lodging their accusation against God. Because the elect of God are God's chosen, and if they're going to try to unseat that election, what they're actually doing is accusing God of electing people that don't deserve to be elected, and they should not be elected because these things are true about them, and we're going to bring these charges and prove to you that you're not being righteous or holy or whatever. And that's a pretty pitiful position to be in. It's an unenviable position to be in the position of having to challenge God in his own courtroom. I wouldn't want to be in that position, but that's what they're actually admitting by their bringing their charges. Because when they charge the elect of God, their real problem's God, not us. The one who has set us up as those who will receive all that God has for those for whom he has ministered in terms of verses 26 and following. His own Spirit ministers to us by praying for us to the Father in such a way that the Father's not going to turn those requests down. Hebrews 7 says Jesus prays for us and God's not going to turn those prayers down. So this whole issue of God being willing to do all these things for us, for our spiritual growth and maturity and ultimate sanctification, the real problem is that God has decided he's going to do this for these people, and the adversaries say, you can't legitimately do that. These people are rotten. They don't deserve any kind of treatment like you've set them up for, and it's wrong for you to charge them that way. And that's a pretty serious accusation, but that's where it starts. And in the details of their tactics, not only at the root of their tactics is this recognition, you know, we really do have to deal with this God because he is the omnipotent one. We really can't get around having, we have to deal with him. So the way we're going to deal with him, in the details of their tactics, there are two issues that arise. One of them is in the statement, bringing a charge against. That word that's translated to bring a charge against or laying a charge against someone is a verb that's only used 7 times in the New Testament. It's only used by Paul 3 times. It's found in our current context written by Paul. And then it's found again in Acts 26, 2 and 7, which is Luke's record of Paul's words. So Paul used the words 2 times in Luke's record. And then Luke additionally uses the same term 4 more times in the book of Acts. And in these 7 uses, it's pretty really clear what he's saying. The issue is, in both this text and in the 2 times that Paul is quoted in Acts 26, and in the other uses, the other 4 times, in every case, Luke uses the phrase, laying a charge against, to describe what happens when you have a problem with somebody and you decide to take them to court. This is a legal issue. One of those records in Acts was the upheaval that occurred in Ephesus when Demetrius and some of those people that were making the idols to Diana the Ephesian, the great goddess Diana, they were sweating the fact that so many of the people in Ephesus were turning to Paul's God in Christ, and they were burning their witchcraft books and getting rid of their idols, and all of these people that made and sold these idols for a living were, you know, they were terrified that they were going to lose their living. So they threw a hissy fit, and they created this great big tumult, and all these people were screaming, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," and for hours. Finally, the clerk of the city got their attention and said, "Men and brethren, if you have a problem with these guys, you need to lay a charge against them. The courts are open." And he said, if you don't handle it this way, we'll have charges leveled against us by Rome in court. And we'll have to give an answer for why we allowed this kind of behavior. So the courts are open. You take it to court. You lay your charges. You see what the judges say. And in that follow-up, the idea there is that Luke establishes the meaning for the term. It's a specific legal setting under law, and it is in the face of somebody that represents the enforcer of that law. You take it to the judges, they make their decision, then the power of Rome is behind their decision, and whatever Rome has said will happen as long as Rome can make it happen. That's the whole issue of a court. You take your case before the judge, you make your accusations, you prove them to his satisfaction, and then you get him to render a verdict that the power of Rome will execute for you. That's the goal. And in Paul's quotes that he is quoted as in Acts 26, 2 and 7, he's in court. And he says, I'm glad I stand here before you to give answer to those who've laid these charges against me. Because I know that you're familiar with all of these issues of the Jews and all that. And I'm just going to answer these accusations. And then in chapter 26, in both verses 2 and 7, he uses this term to refer to the fact that I'm in your court. And they've laid these charges against me. And they can't prove them. And I'm going to prove to you that they can't prove them. And in fact, he does. He doesn't have to go any... I mean, they say after all of this... Well, if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, we could turn him loose. But because he appealed to Caesar, he's got to go before Caesar. But when he gets to before Caesar, Caesar's going to say the same thing we'd say, and that is, you guys are just in a big religious argument, and it doesn't have anything to do with our law, so just get out of court, that kind of thing. They know it's going to happen that way, or at least they think they know that. So when he uses this term, who shall lay a charge against, he's putting the opponents right in that unenviable position of arguing their case in the court of the one that they've already implied doesn't have the qualifications to make the decisions because they're arguing against his elect. It's an unenviable position, not only to be in God's court, but to have to argue your case to try to make God realize that he's blown it. You really messed things up here, God, because you didn't follow your own rules and regulations and character and all that. It's your fault. That's basically their thing, and then the details of these tactics, it's always legal court-type setting. The court setting in Romans, when it says who shall lay a charge, it's talking about God's courts, not Roman courts. Paul isn't saying here that nobody can bring a charge against God's elect in the Roman courts. That's going to happen. And it happened to him, and it's happened to hundreds, if not thousands, of other believers in the time period. He's arguing about laying a charge against God's elect in God's court. And so the second part of this laying a charge thing is that the objects of the opponent's ire are supposedly the elect of God. They're the ones that are having these charges laid against them. And there's a lot of objection regarding these people identified as elect, because everybody knows that the opponents of election oppose the concept of specific individuals, and everybody also knows that their election doesn't make them perfect. And so they still do stupid, sinful, wicked things, and therefore they're open to charges if the court is open to accepting those charges. And that's the whole heart of the gospel. The court rendered its verdict against Jesus in our stead. The court of heaven rendered its verdict against Jesus in our stead. So once Jesus died on Calvary and was raised on the third day to prove that his work at Calvary had been sufficient and effective, because it was God that raised him from the dead, it was himself that raised him from the dead. It was the Spirit of God that raised him from the dead. The scriptures teach all three of them raising from the dead to validate the claims that what he did at Calvary was sufficient and efficient for those who believe. So if he died for our sins there, our sins have been addressed. Have been addressed. So that there is no charge that can be brought without another unenviable position, and that is that what Christ did at Calvary wasn't sufficient. Death is a very unenviable thing because it denigrates the death of the Son of God and makes His blood an unholy thing. And we already know that God doesn't take that very kindly. So the opponents of the elect of God are opponents of the individuals whom God has chosen to bless and to refuse to impute their sin to them. So the opponents are really not attacking these non-specific people as the elect. They're attacking individuals who have done things that are illegal. They're contrary to God's law. That's the only way you can lay a charge. God, your own command was this, and this person that you elected has already done that against that law. You said don't commit adultery, and this person I'm accusing of adultery in your court because it's a fact, committed adultery. That's what's going on here. But this charge against God's elect ultimately is a charge against the elector. You chose these people, you commanded them to do that, and then they did this, and you're doing nothing about it. And we're in this court to make things be done about it, if we can. But that puts them in that position again of trying to get God to admit that He's unqualified to be the God in His own court, and that what He did with Jesus at Calvary was not a legitimate way to deal with the sins of the elect. They have to say to God, the death of His own Son was wasted effort because that wasn't sufficient for what they've done. And that brings us to the issue of the futility. They have their tactics. They're going to bring their charges. But it's a futile thing because at the very roots of reason, it is unreasonable to attack the God of the courtroom. That's just absolutely dumber than a stump. Even a stump wouldn't do that. God, by fundamental definition, is the executor of power. And there's nobody to take over if He recuses Himself. You don't think I'm qualified? Okay, I'll recuse myself. Who are you going to put in His place? Who has the power to overcome His power so that He can act as the God? When God has stepped aside and said, okay, I won't be the God here. There isn't anybody. It's unreasonable. And even if the opponents could succeed in establishing the illegitimacy of the judge, who would take his place? That's what Satan wants, his place. But Satan is, he hasn't gotten anywhere near the qualifications that are required of omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, infinite wisdom. He hasn't got any of these qualifications. He can't be the judge. He doesn't have the qualifications. So, the fact that God is in the position of final arbiter establishes the fact that nobody can be against us. Nobody has a snowball's chance in the hot place of getting this court to rule against us. It ain't happening. Now, see, I've already linguistically corrupted my whole thing. I said ain't, and I said snowball's place in the hot place. But anyway, it isn't happening. You can't get God to go against His own court and against His own character in His own court to satisfy your accusations against these elect of God. It isn't going to happen. They're in this unenviable position of trying to attack omnipotence, which they admit they don't have. And even if they don't admit they don't have it, they know they don't have it as soon as it's applied to them. So at the very point of this specific attack, the decision has already been rendered. There is no accusation that can be laid against me in the court of heaven that hasn't already been addressed. Because the already been addressed stuff is actually on the basis of the statement that Paul makes. Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? God is the one who justifies. Okay? Done deal. You can make your accusation if you feel like an idiot, but the God who you're making the accusation both against and in His courtroom has already done what He required, and that was back there in verse 30 where he justified those that he had called. The justification is a done fact. It's accomplished. You can't get that reversed. So, with the judge having already justified his elect, the attack is doomed to fail. Before it's ever really even put into action, it's doomed to fail. At the roots of God's defeat of his opponents is his established accomplishment. In history, indisputably, he gave his son to fulfill his own laws, requirements of his own character and justice. And he satisfied the requirements of that justice absolutely, fully, and beyond any amount of human sins. And the accusers find God at fault for lawlessness because they don't believe that the death of the Son of God should be the answer to the sin problem. But it's their unbelief that puts them in this untenable position. So they have to deny the efficacy and legitimacy of God's solution to God's desire to be just and justifier. That's Romans 3. God wants to be just and justifier. Well, in the human way of thinking, you can't do that. If you are just, you can't justify a sinner. And if you're going to justify a sinner, you're not just. So God says, yeah, I figured out a way to do that. Romans chapter 3. I'll let my son be the next Adam, and I'll create a totally new human race in him from that race that's in Adam who are willing to trust in the promise that I will declare them righteous if they'll just trust my promise. God's satisfied with that, and being omnipotent, he doesn't care if anybody else is satisfied with it or not. If the adversaries don't like it, where will they go for recourse? They've already tried the court of heaven. It didn't work. Where are they going to go? There's no place to go. That's why Paul says, if God is for us, who is against us in any kind of efficacious way? And the answer is, none. Nobody. If they try to bring a charge against God's elect, he's the one who's already justified. It's a done deal. That puts them in the position unenviably. I've said that over and over because it's a recurring theme. They're in the unenviable position of being in God's court. They're in the unenviable position of having to accuse the God of the court of not being legitimate. They're in the unenviable position of being irrational. And then they have to deny the gospel itself and the efficacy of the death of the Son of God for the sins of humanity. And it's really the gospel that's at root here, because our gospel at its root is that God handled our sin problem at the cross. Handled it. Fully, effectively handled it. The only thing he requires of any human being is that they embrace that truth. Believe it. Once they've believed it, God declares them righteous. It's all over. Nobody can be against us. Effectively.